So EPDP have external counsel on hand to answer questions like this, and their answers have been exceptionally good so far, Bird and Bird, the firm. So we might want to phrase this question as a choice of, you know, between is there a difference in liability between registries and registrars answering questions directly versus via ICANN. That might tease out some of this liability question, rather than saying is there a benefit. It's because it's a nebulous question to ask, is there a liability benefit, because you have to baseline your liability. So to ask for a differential analysis might be more telling.
Johnson, the queue, then Jody.
So thinking back to when we started this, right, we had some assumptions, and what we heard from Joran is when we have a model that ICANN will then go and test that with the DPAs, etc. So if we flag that question came up, then it can be taken to the DPAs and they can get an answer on that. Right? That is one way forward.
Jody? Maybe other ways forward.
Jody?
I agree with Benedict that we should take this to legal and ask him about that, but then at the same time, I'm not sure that we should even get legal involved. I mean, we haven't up to this point, so why bring him in now? State what we have said, that, you know, we were just trying to do this, but...
Andy?
Yeah, I don't really have an opinion on whether we ask legal now or wait for it to come out. But I do think we should at some point seek clarification. Does every single request require, the note here says requirement to check every request as required by GDPR for legitimacy. And if that is true, it's very critical. So
I think Jody, Andy's response is directly responding to your question on why ask, because that may have a direct impact on the technology choices being made here. There's Elisa, and then back to John.
Thanks. I think this goes back to what I've said before when we've raised questions that we may want to take up with the legal department, which is I'm not sure they'll be able to answer this. This could be a very, this is a matter of interpretation of law. And we don't really know the answer to this, which is why I think it may be appropriate to include it perhaps as a consideration or as John was suggesting. I understand the point that obviously this could have a significant impact to the technical solution, but I don't know that we can say one way or another whether this is true or how, what part of a request has to be checked and how it needs to be checked, and so forth. It raises a lot more questions than a simple yes or no. So I can certainly ask the question. I'm just going to tell you.
So I'm not
you,
sure
I think
that
that's
it
likely.
Belongs in consideration, because that's direct. I mean, at least we've done it so far. That's intended as actions for other parties, while here there is the response to that. This question directly might impact our own model. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that what we ought to be doing is in the description, you know, performance of the model or something like that, maybe we ought to create a section that says that depending upon whether every query has to be validated or not, it may have some impact on the performance of this model, and that future development work will have to be done by future, you know, TSG teams, et cetera, to figure out what to do. Gavin?
Steve, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yes. Excuse me, yes. Rather than force a decision here and try to get an answer to this binary question, suppose you enlarge the picture just slightly and say, in principle, that some number of requests come in and get handled automatically, some number of requests come in and require manual treatment. Now, that raises the question, well, how do you know which ones are which? I'm going to bookmark that and put that aside for a second. Can we design the system in such a way that we encompass both possibilities, And then the degenerate or extreme cases where they're all one or all the other becomes a simplification of that. But more likely, I mean, the common sense, it seems to me, that if every request has to be handled manually, we're dead. And on the other hand, if we make no provision for handling some things manually, then it's brittle. And so if you encompass the possibility of both, let me look ahead a little bit. I want to say some longer words about quantification and measurement and so forth, but you can probably compute my comment just from that, but I'll break off on it. But the main thing is with respect to this item, rather than try to go through legal and get a thing, design the system so that it has flexibility, can handle either of these, and then as those decisions are made, it will fit with whatever with the design that we've got.
Gavin?
Yeah, I agree with what Steve just said, but I think I wanted to just remind people we actually did talk about this during the first face-to-face meeting. We were talking about two different modes, the synchronous and synchronous, and we ended up. We haven't talked about it much, but in the document there is, like, apart from all the clever RDAP stuff, there is the web-based form, and the idea was that you know, if the policy outcome or the policy development process, the outcome of that was that there were some forms of requests for non-public data that could be satisfied in an automated way, then they would go down the RDAP channel. But if there were requests that had to be manually verified, then they would go down the web-based form channel. Now, so I think our document actually does cover the spectrum of responses, because the question, does every request have to be manually verified, has three possible answers: yes, no, and maybe, or yes and no, and it depends. And I think those three possible answers are all covered already by our document, but we maybe are not doing a good job of picking that out and making it explicit, because we did get a few questions about that.
So that's a very good point. I want to note that even with the web-based one ad hoc thing, it is possible to get an access token that's good for one time, and then you could use the RDAP channel, which may be something that some people need for their tooling. So where was I going beyond that? I think that's a good thing. We need to maybe more clearly put in the document. I don't know where it is, but maybe we need to more clearly say that. That's all I really have on that. Should I continue?
Yes.
Okay. I noted the same thing Scott did about the listing the different example authorized users, and I think some people kind of got hung up on that, and I see why now. I think we need to put in the document an ability to, or the ability for pseudo-anonymized data to law enforcement, because that question kept coming up, and it's just something we need to say, yes, the system supports that, although there needs to be policy that specifies the levels of pseudo-anonymity, whatever, because there's it's not just, you can't just say do it, mm-hmm. right? So there's more to it than that. Maybe it's not policy, that's requirements driven by policy. Overall, my overall thing coming out of the consultation with the NCSG was that somewhere in our document, we probably need to talk about privacy being important. I think it's if it's in there, it's probably not very clear. And I could, you know, reading the room there, I think they came in and was like, you guys are just trying to give all the data away, you know. And we were, at the end of it, they were like, oh, no, you're, that's not what you're trying to do. So I think we just probably need to put that in there. And that would probably go a long way with when that document's handed over to the DPAs as well. I noted the thing about notifications as well. So I think we need to throw that in there. And just generally, my last comment is this process has kind of made me question whether we should put a FAQ in the document. take some of the questions that were actually asked of us and actually put answers to them, and that might be helpful. That's all I have.
Thanks, Andy. I really like your FAQ idea. I think that makes a lot of sense. And what I think we should do is, after we're done with this round, with these rounds here, and we've extracted the technical things that we are saying need to go into the document, whatever else is there and left, et cetera, I think we should, you know, build that FAQ and make that a part of the document. Thanks, Andy. Gustavo?
Yeah, I have several things. I also participate on, well, I was the, there was an ARDAP session on how ARDAP works, and I also received a lot of questions, so that's also part of those questions. And the first one is reverse search. It appears that everyone is asking about reverse search. I know that it's not defined yet how it's going to work on ARDAP. We have the internet draft on the ITF, but we need to say something in the document like, if reverse search is implemented, it should have different SLAs, or it should work like this, or, I mean, something. We should say something about how this could be implemented or how this could work, because that appears to be like a really important topic for a lot of people. And we need to be pretty clear that probably it's not the same interface, probably it's not the same SLA, probably, I mean, something needs to be there.
Yeah, I mean, that was the one thing I had left after everybody gone around and you stole it, but that's good. But I think it's more generic. RDAP's extensible. There could be other things apart from reverse search, and we should probably say something about that. That, you know, yeah, the system's going to have to evolve.
So I think I agree with you. We need to put something in there about reverse search. The other thing about specifically about reverse search is that the way we've designed specified this with the ICANN gateway. We need to put this in the document as well. Is that ICANN gateway can be the nexus for how that reverse search works, because otherwise you have clients trying to figure out who to talk to, and that's very difficult to do. Yeah, it could be a nightmare.
I have a real issue with this. So it's fine. I mean, there is a reverse search draft in the ITF. I read it the other day. It looked absolutely fine. I don't see why we couldn't implement it today. Absolutely fine for implementing reverse search at an individual registry. But if we have a single access service that's run by ICANN, people are going to expect to be able to search across the entire GTLD space. So they're going to say, I want to see every domain name registered under every TLD by anyone who has this email address. So that RDAP gateway is going to have to go out to every single GTLD RDAP service to query there, and then it's going to have to query every single registrar RDAP service for each domain name it finds in the search results from the registry, and aggregate all that stuff down together and send one response back to the client who's making that request. I can't see that working.
Yeah, maybe that's in the security considerations, you know, DDoS, how to.
Yeah, I mean, it's yeah, I mean, one query against this I cannot reverse RDAP search is going to potentially result in billions of queries against the registry service and the RDAP registrar service.
Gustavo, and then Jody, and then John.
Okay, maybe not billions, millions.
Exactly, and that's basically what I'm saying. We need to say something, right? Maybe we need to say that it's not a good idea or that it's not implementable. I mean, we need to say something about that.
I would actually say that we should say that reverse search is out of scope for us.
Well, Gavin, I don't know that that's enough, because it's one thing to say it's out of scope for us. It's another thing to say, done wrong, reverse scope is actually bad for the system as a whole, and therefore we recommend that should there be reverse search, it should be under these kinds of strict parameters. I think it's better for us to specify that than just to say it's out of scope.
I agree. That'll be a very useful exercise, and we'll probably preempt a whole bunch of pain later on.
Thanks. Jody, and then John. Thanks. John?
So my only question on that, and I agree in principle, but I don't know the answer to this, is that in scope for us to do that, or is that something we should push to ESSAC, or does it belong somewhere? I mean, it needs to be said. Is it in scope for us to say it? I don't know.
It seems to me like it would be a good topic for the ESSAC to determine the feasibility of a GTLD-wide reverse search service.
I don't think it's our remit to figure out who does the work on it. So I'd like to stop that part of our discussion on should be SAC or whatever. That's out of scope for us. But I do think that it is in scope, John, for us to say that down this path lie trouble, and therefore, if there is a desire for reverse search, it ought to be constrained by at least these things. Okay. But to actually do it, it needs more work done by some other body.
Else. Yeah, okay.
Okay, so there's Andy, then there's Benedict.
Yeah, so I just want to, if when we talk about this, we might want to note that allowing, you know, clients individually to try to do reverse search is probably going to be detrimental, right? You don't want it, we want it constrained. We want ICANN's gateway doing it because we know it can be controlled at that point. We don't want people trying to do this on their own because that just spells trouble.
Benedict?
I think that's an excellent way to phrase this. We also got a question about who was Type Services. Do we have, it's not the same issue of sort of combinatorial explosion, but it does present different challenges, and I'm sure Jody will have something to say. But it might.
You're talking about who was, to be able to do a who was search? You thought the GTLD, doing a reverse search on the GTL space was bad. I mean, you're talking about who owned this? I mean, it could transfer between 50 registrars. I guess I don't understand your question then.
I think we need to flag the answer in a similar with exactly that answer and say again, this has complexities such as identifying the registrar at the given time, because that, as far as I know, that data is not stored. So you have if it's not with the current registrar, then doing a who was search is, at the moment there's no transfer metadata list who had that domain at a particular time. But these are questions we are being asked, so we need to answer them and explain why they're
so
difficult.
So if you go back and look at the questions, you know, this is from Alex Deacon in the community session, and he says, is there a timestamp to deliver the data? Historical data, how is that held? And Andy's response was, at Aaron we have who was, we TSG discuss these things, but we rule them out of scope because it basically complicates things to a degree beyond our remit. That's what we said.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so my understanding, so there was a separate question about who was, I thought from in the GAC PSWG. My understanding is that Alex Deacon was asking a different question. I haven't checked this with him. I think he was asking, do we get to know the freshness of data question, which is different to who was. So when, in other words, this is a lawyer's question about, I want to know at this given time, right, at the time of asking what the answer is. If there's a manual process or if there's some asynchronous process going in, I need to be clear when, for a court filing, for example, the timestamp at the point the data was generated. That's a non-trivial question for lawyers. I know it seemed relatively straightforward for us. So he wants to know whether there's going to be preservation of data at the time of the asking, if there's a subsequent lengthy asynchronous process for approval.
Benedict, you're suggesting that we ask that question and we stick it in the FAQ. Is that what you're suggesting?
We need to be clear that there is no storage envisaged in this system, and the data will be generated. Well, data will be produced at the time it's generated. As far as I understand it.
Okay. So I have John and then Jody.
And all I was going to say is that a lot of these questions, we don't need to put them in the model. The FAQ is perfect for answering a lot of this kind of stuff. And I think we've got a little bit more leeway around scope and stuff. While it's out of scope, it's a frequently asked question, so here's some thoughts.
Thanks, Jody.
So RDAP includes a tag that says last update of the RDAP database. It already has that in there. Will that cover it? Okay.
Thanks. Andy?
Yeah, so I just want to talk about the who was portion of this. It might be, so I think we do need to rule it out of scope, and maybe in explaining ourselves, One of the things we could say is just doing what we've already specified requires a lot of policy decisions. Walk before you run type thing. Who was is going to escalate the policy decisions tenfold. Let's just get this done first before we start talking about moonshots.
Thank you. Gustavo.
So, yeah, the other issue that came to my mind was when someone was saying, hey, what happens if legal enforcement, they want to do a lot of queries because they want to have the data just in case, right? And I remember the conversation when I was working in the clearinghouse, there was a model in which we will push the whole database of the clearinghouse to the contracted parties. And we were thinking about using stenography, so to be able to recognize who disclosed the data, right? So we need to say something about that, right? Like if someone disclosed the data that they received, it may not be possible to be able to identify who was that person. Or even we may consider to add some kind of a unique identifier to the RDAP response. Probably you will just remove it if you want to disclose the data, right? But maybe we need to add something for that purpose or say that is that going to be possible to identify who is disclosing that data in case that happens. I think that needs to be addressed.
Thank you.
Map makers do that, don't they?
They put deliberately wrong things in their maps, and then when they get copied into their competitors' maps.
And differential privacy, I'm just going to say that. We might want to consider differential privacy. You hide your real requests in a bunch of fake ones, basically. So it's a means of protecting the identity of the requestor. Apple implement with it when they're sending your health data up to servers. So they'll just generate a bunch of data which is statistically in line with the real data, but it doesn't skew it, but it hides the real stuff.
So you're talking about. No, I want to understand what you're saying. So the requester asks a lot of questions. Only one is the real question they want to ask. My feeling on that is that's a policy question. I know how I personally feel about it, which is I get very upset about that type of thing. But I think it's a policy question.
The other issue that I notice is it appears that the contracted parties, they don't like the idea of being like dumb servers, right? You receive the query and you just need to respond to that query, right? So maybe we need to accommodate something in the model to have some kind of communication from the contracted parties RDAP servers to the gateway. I mean, maybe it's not needed for GDPR at this moment, or we cannot see it, but maybe in the future those contracted parties may need to tell us, you know, I did my homework and it appears that these queries from this pseudo-anonymized whatever appears to be something wrong, so this is my reply. I'm not going to provide you the information because of this. So I think that we need to add something there or say that, yeah, there is a way for the contracted parties to communicate back to the gateway that something is wrong or something.
Okay, John.
Yeah, and I think that was very similar to what Jody was saying about the need to be able to reject stuff. So the only other thing that I have left, unless somebody already mentioned it, is there was a request about the data subjects being able to find out who queried them over time, like the transparency question. And I don't know what we're going to do with that one. It's logging, right? So it could be done if the policy's in place.
So is that different than the notification issue? So can you describe that?
Well, actually, do I know the notification enough to know that it's exactly different? So I'm a data subject, and basically I want to come in and I want to file a request to find out data about who queried me. And I don't know what those data elements are, right? I mean, ideally I want to know who, when, and why, right? But I may not have that right. But some process as a data subject to be find out information about my queries, whether it's the amount, whatever the policy is. Mm-hmm. So somebody raised that in, can't remember which session, but it was a question we were asked.
Gustavo, then Andy.
Do we need to address that? The
I think we're covered, right, in the model? Because it's just logging.
Yeah, we have logging auditing, requirements, sorry. But then I think you at some point have to define what it is they can ask for. I don't know.
No, well, that's policy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, I guess we can mention it and then future work.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, Steve.
Thank you. I've got half a dozen specific items here, some of which are a little bit naughty. K-N-O-T. And they range over things, so bear with me a bit. With respect to what we're doing, how it's understood and perceived by the public, a question which I was sort of surprised hasn't come up, but certainly was in my mind. How does the requester know which information is public versus non-public? In that this is a system to provide the non-public information, does the requester know in advance whether he's asking for public versus non-public information? And the second question is closely related. Even if he knows he's asking for a non-public information, does he know what information to expect to come back for a given request? As opposed to, he may not get everything, he may get some portion of it. So those are sort of two parts of the same picture of, from the requesting side, what's the expectation? Are the rules clear to everybody, or is it a surprise or a testing experience of that?
Yeah, if I can add, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, Steve, but the RDAP profile would return redacted for privacy. So it will return all the fields, the labels, but for the tag or for the answer, it would say redacted for privacy in there. So for instance, if the registrant name couldn't be given out, it would just say registrant name, and then redacted for privacy. That's how the RDAP profile works. I don't know if that needs to be called out in there. Like there should be a little more documentation on it. And then as far as how does the requester know if they're making a public or a private request, they'll have to be accredited, so they'll have to send in. I mean, I think that, well, it's a good question. I mean, if you're getting accredited, you know you're asking a private query. But if you have no idea what private or public is, then you're just asking for a public query because that's the default that you know. But I'm not sure that I'm asking your question or answering, sorry.
Well, here's sort of a trivial portion of this. If you make a private query, do you get back the public information as well?
Yes. Yes, you should get back. You should always get back public information. And maybe that this all needs to be called out in there. You know, like a truth table, I guess, basically.
I mean, for me, it's pretty clear, for example, that the phone number is PII, right? But the question is, should the model accommodate to say, hey, these fields that you're getting, like a phone number, because you're accredited, it's PII, so you should be careful with this data or not? I mean, should that model say that or not? I mean, are we assuming...
Yeah, I think that's a policy thing, you know, be careful with the data that you get or that you use. That's okay, great, but not technical.
I mean, in RDAP, you will get the phone number with the actual phone number, right? But how do I know that a phone number is PII, is non-public data? Because as Jody was mentioning, you have mixed public data and non-public data, right? I mean, it's pretty clear for us because we're in this business, right? But I don't know if it's clear for everybody.
I think that question is beyond the remit of this. And the only reason I say that is because I've heard the same question in other ICANN meetings. So you're bringing up the whole thing about liability right there. How's the person supposed to know that they were liable for it? Well, they should have known because they were accredited. You know, now they're responsible. But
maybe, but again, I think in terms of what the TSG does, at best, I think you log it, you stick it in the FAQ piece, and say it's not us.
Steve.
Yeah, no, I think that's a heads-up question. I think it is very, very sensible and appropriate for the system to have the capability of having a tag as to whether or not this is public versus non-public data, whether it's PII. Just labeling it like that provides the data necessary for the receiver to be then on notice that that's the way that data is labeled.
So this Jody,
you guys working?
I think we're getting into the RDAP profile here. I don't know if this is what we're supposed to be doing. We're just saying something gets returned. It's up to ICANN to say whether that, you know, with its truth table and how they want to update the RDAP profiles up to.
No, but it's more than just whether or not it gets returned. The truth table will tell you whether it's returned or whether you, okay, but also whether it's labeled in addition to that as to what its status is.
I understand what you're saying. To the contracted parties, we're required to turn RDAP profile. Now, is the RDAP profile going to change to have that label on there? Or is ICANN going to take that response, because they're the only people that can get it, and add that item on there?
I think that we should add in the considerations that whatever model, it's the final model, should have that kind of functionality of tagging what is public or non-public. And you don't have an idea how many questions I receive about if the IP addresses in the Glue records, and this is from ICANN, I mean from ICANN, right, internally, if it's PII or not, and I need to explain, well, this is the Glue record, it's an IP address, so it's public in the DNS. So, I mean, I think it's not clear to a lot of people what is PII or not.
Okay, so Benedict and Jody.
So that we're not asking, I don't think the suggestion is to make any determination by ICANN, merely to say what ICANN has, according to the application of this truth table, what ICANN has unredacted, as it were. Is that clear?
No. I don't know. John?
Yeah, so what ROM's disassembling this microphone, that's pretty funny. The, if I understood the issue, is there's the question is whether we should try to decide what is PII and what is not, and I don't think we should.
Yes, tag.
Versus tagging, having some tagging. Sort of formal way in the response to say, this element is PII, this one is not, right?
And have a consideration in the document saying that model or the final model or if another TSG reviews this in the future, they need to come up with something to address this.
Sorry, I don't want to do that kind of stuff. I mean, we don't care, you know, I don't think we kick a technical question down the road. If it's a technical question and we have the ability to actually respond to it, we should respond to it now rather than wait for some time in the future. Because I don't know that a future group is going to have any better ability to respond than us.
I was just going to say so there are two ways we can do it in RDAP. We can either define an additional status and say the contents of this object contain some of the data elements in this object are personally identifying information. Use caution, handle with care, or we could define an extension, and you could then enumerate the specific fields in that object which contain the PII. But I can't comment on, you know, how exactly. I mean, those are just my thoughts.
Okay, back to you, Steve.
Thank you. Next item, I want to go back to the earlier discussion about the word assumptions, giving this some more thought. What we've labeled as assumptions, I think it should be labeled something else, maybe ground rules or some other wording. Those are the guidance given to us, instructions given to us. Mm-hmm. We do also have things that I would call assumptions that have come up in the discussion just now about, for example, is the data kept in a distributed form or is it aggregated? Is it, and there's a number of things. I haven't tried to record them, but I think there is a distinct and separate category for the assumptions we have made in the design process that's different from what the guidance that was handed down to us. And so I would repurpose the word assumptions to gather the stuff that we haven't yet been clear about, but it's become clear in some of the discussion, and I would choose a different term to document the ground rules that were given to us than the parameters that. So that's that. Let me move on to an entirely different thing. We've talked about logging, and we also talked about sensitivity and not logging or somehow hiding the fact that certain queries are made by certain people and so forth. I don't think we've been clear enough about the relationship and the decisions about all of that. And it's I think it's important to put all of that in there. And my understanding and strong belief is the right way to do it is that in principle, everything gets logged. So things that are too sensitive to put into a general log get curtained off and put somewhere else, but they have to be accessible for accountability and prevention of abuse and so forth. And the an analogy is that in highly classified environments, the fact that somebody's looking at something might not be something you want visible, but nonetheless, you control that and you make it accessible to also appropriately cleared people who can then look at things. Otherwise, you have systems that can go sideways. And just from a mechanical point of view, if you're trying to debug things, you lose track of that. So I think a clear-cut description of those issues and the decisions associated with that and the system consequences, because that does have a consequence on them. No discussion, I move on to the next thing.
Well, I really like that you volunteered to add that piece.
Let me try that again. Eek! I'll give it a shot.
Tomofumi.
There's one thing I wanted to mention about logging and audits. So when you have an audit, that the person that's going to audit is the auditor. Usually it's not the general public or the people out there. We probably should consider who the auditor might be. And the auditors usually have some sort of contract, or NDA or whatever, between the auditee. So the sensitive things usually don't leak out. And you have an audit so that you can prove that everything is in order to the public.
Yes. So audit is requires credential and vetting and authorization. But the scenarios that are important with respect to not disclosing the fact that a query has been made moves into a more restricted environment in which the people who make those kinds of queries will not likely trust the general auditor to have access to that information.
One concern I have is if you scrub the log, that's kind of not the original log. Usually it's not acceptable in audits.
Yeah, and the direction that I'm imagining is that you have, for the sake of discussion, two separate logs. You have the normal log and you have the special log, and everything gets logged somewhere, and then you go with that. Next item. Should I go move on?
Yeah.
Eek!
You can redact that last piece.
Put that in the very special log. Quantification. Over time, there's been lots of small comments about, is this going to have heavy use or very light use? How many queries are going to be made? How many people are going to be using it and so forth? I don't think we know. I'm anticipating it will get much heavier use, but The data that Elliot Noss shared about what's happening with TUCAS suggests that it's fairly low. I don't think we have at least I don't have any strong sense of how this goes. I do think it's important to add to our specification of what's to be built is measurement and comparison with models and so forth, because it's quite one thing if the numbers are low, and if the numbers are much higher, it will have an impact on system design. So I would include not only an estimate of what the rates or volumes of queries and so forth, and have some degree of modeling of, you know, recording it and comparison with what you expect. But I would also then also try to quantify how many types of errors, how many errors of various types are made. So how often is a query rejected, for example, either because it's malformed or because, say, from the previous discussion, the registrar decides that they aren't going to answer that. They go through manual interaction. So, as I say, a degree of quantification over both of those things, the basic flow of things and also what the error conditions are, is an important part of the system design.
I very much agree with Steve. And what I was trying to say it without the coffee this morning is that it might be better to give some sort of estimate of the effort to actually build the system. Because there were some questions about, oh, how much is it going to cost, or how much effort it's going to take. It's going to take 1 million years or $1 billion. So the measurement would help to estimate how much effort it would take to build the parts. And I think it might be better to include that in the document.
And let me build on what you said. And having said that, asking as part of the maybe in the considerations, additional consideration section, that there be feedback from the early testing and piloting or early experience compared to what the estimates are, so we can identify what we don't know. So these will be known unknowns, if you like, and then we get feedback on all of that.
Andy?
Yeah, so there's two parts to what you said there. I want to address the issue about that Elliot brought up about the number of queries and whether this is going to be used. I thought his data was interesting. I will say that I attended the GAC Who Is Privacy session, and I think this even came up in the session right before we went into the GAC. They do surveys of, I'm assuming, law enforcement, and their surveys before the temp spec went into effect were, hey, the vast majority of us are getting good answers out of Who Is, and when the temp spec went into effect, now the surveys are saying 2/3 of us don't like this. It needs to be better. So that seems to be at odds with what Elliot is saying, in my opinion. That's how I interpret both sets of data, that what Elliot's information is very interesting and useful, but I question whether he's seeing the whole picture.
And if it wasn't clear, I'm 100% agreeing with you, and rather than accepting a particular, you know, whether it's Elliot or anything else, I said we don't know, and so we identify that as an important area that we can make perhaps some initial estimates or we can relay something, but identify that that's an important area that has to be quantified, has to be reported, and has to be reconciled with whatever we are, and that will be important in the evolution of the system.
Okay, so that brings us to the second part of what you were saying, which was the costs, essentially, and trying to do an estimate of just how big the system is. As I start thinking about this, the actual costs for running the servers and even writing the software, I think, is smaller, especially the operational cost, the OPEX, but running the servers. If you use cloud technology, you could start small and then scale up with not much of a problem. I think the vast majority of the cost for the system, and this is a very good, this may be a good question to ask the ICANN board, Because I think a lot of the cost is going to go into the compliance of this. Mm-hmm. Who gets accredited? How do they get accredited? How does the auditing work? And that's going to cost probably much more than the actual operations of the system, the technical operations of the system. And if we come, we've said a lot here, and we've gotten a lot of feedback. And I think it probably needs to be asked, is ICANN actually willing to put up the funds for this?
Yeah, so let me say a couple of comments about that. First, a small anecdote. Some 20-odd years ago, I was a co-founder of CyberCash, which pioneered payments on the Internet. And one of the other founders who had a lot of experience in the banking industry and system design came up to me, and he said, I was in charge of the development process. He said, Steve, you know the 80-20 rule? I said, yeah. He said, it's 99-1 here. 1% of your transactions are going to be costs, are going to account for 99% of your actual expenses. And I think that there will be some effects like that. With respect to what you're suggesting about challenging, in some sense, the way I interpret what you said, I think we can take a more measured approach and simply say we think that these areas need to be quantified, and so as advice, as part of the other considerations that sort of caution for the system design of whoever takes over from us, rather than saying, we think you guys are out of your mind and you don't have any idea what you're talking about, which is kind of the tone that I would interpret from that.
No, I wasn't saying they were out of their mind. What I was saying is I think there's a substantial cost to this, and I don't know if anyone has actually said, yes, this is going to happen. So
in line with my previous comment about quantification, one could also say it's worth having some quantification of the costs of the system, and to take the what we know about the design at this point, and then raise the question of trying to cost all that and have that be as a baseline model that is then reconciled with what the facts turn out to be.
Okay. So I agree that would be great to do. How do we do that? I don't have the expertise to go.
No, it's not for us to do.
Okay.
It's for us to say that that's an issue, and for whoever takes this over and then says, we're going to build this and we can do all this. Or if it's divided up into pieces, which it will be, that the accreditation people and the authentication people and the authorization people provide the cost estimates, and then that gets matched against whoever is the big honcho in charge of this overall design.
That's an excellent idea.
Yeah. I got one more. So I had written this down before, and there was some discussion, but I want to go back to it, which is queries that are by email or by phone number or by subject, which are across multiple registrations, in effect. In the expert working group several years ago, one of the very active people was Susan Kamiguchi, who at that time was working for Facebook and was described the kinds of queries that she would make regularly to vet different businesses that she had to deal with. And so there were these kinds of queries where she needed information. What other domains are registered by the same name? What other domains is this person involved in, and so forth? And she would look at things. That relates to the other stuff that I've been thinking about, so I chatted with her today. We should say something, either that we're not going to do it, or that it's hard, or we are going to do it, or how we're going to do it, or whatever, with respect to this class of query. I can see both sides of it, that it's a slippery slope if we go too far. And also, it may underplay the system if we say nothing about it, but that turns out to be a major use case.
So, is this the same as the reverse search problem, or otherwise, I'm not.
I to the extent that I understand what reverse search means, I think so, but I'm not 100% certain.
So, Gavin, you read the reverse search draft. Do you want to tell him the...
So the reverse search draft allows you to say, tell me all the domain names that have this as their registrant, or this, and you can specify name, email address, elements of the postal address, and it just returns us. Obviously, RDAP has a search facility built into it, so it's it just extends that, and you just get a list of objects back.
Phone number would be a different one that you could use, for example.
Yeah, pretty much any of the elements that would be recorded in the registry, you can query for name, organization, address, postal address, phone, fax, email. Yeah.
So how does this work in practice? Because in the forward search, you're going to a particular database and getting the information out of there. In this one, you're going to all of the databases.
The draft only talks about how an individual RDAP server would implement search, reverse search. It doesn't say how you would work search across all RDAP servers.
What are we going to say?
I worry about the operability, the scalability and operability of that, because obviously with 1,000 TLDs or 1,200 TLDs, if someone's expecting to be able to do a search across every one of those, then you're rapidly turning into a very large thing that has to happen out of band. You can't expect a search result in the same way you would from Google.
Yeah, Darby Dragons, I think is what we're going to say.
Sorry? Darby Dragons.
I mean, the reason why people ask about reverse search is because you got it for free with Domain Tools. And the way that Domain Tools worked is by aggregating all of that data into their own database, which is why they're in so much trouble, because they did it without anyone's permission. The only way to offer a reverse search in a performant way is to stuff all that stuff in a big single database so you can run a quick query over it.
I have a comment about that. A question. The thing that Domain Tools was doing, I think we kind of you explained it very well. Maybe we should put something in our documents. This is what was going on with these types of tools, but here's the problems with them. They weren't getting permission from the owners of the data, and they weren't really abiding by the rules. So, and that's why that's not a thing we should be trying to replicate.
It's important to say all that. That's different from whether or not it's feasible or advisable to aggregate the data, because if you get the permission, you could do all that.
I would also like to note that. Sorry, Joe, to go.
Well, I was just going to take that one statement. You said they got this for free from Domain Tools. I don't think they got it for free.
Sorry, yeah. Oh, you got it with your Domain Tools subscription. I apologize. Yes, you're right. Yeah, I was going to say that there is some data, the non-public registration data is aggregated in one place, which is at ICANN, because the bulk registration data access system puts it all in one place. But as John has told me on several occasions, there are constraints on how that data can currently be used, which I think, again, that's not something we can answer. That's a policy question.
I mean, in our model, ICANN can go and get any information it wants from the contracted parties, right, based on the query from the requester. What happens, because of this reverse search, appears to be like the killer application for a lot of people. What happens if someone starts suggesting why ICANN should not just get the whole database from all these parties and have like a giant database? I mean, should we say something in the document?
You mean a new business model for ICANN?
I'm just saying, if we need to say something from the,
somehow.
From the, yeah, we need to fund this. No, from the technical perspective. I mean,
I think I'll have that your recommendation go to Elisa.
No, it's
I'm just kidding. You did not make a recommendation. I know your ICANN org staff. You made no recommendation. We're just joking here, okay? Just to be clear.
No, yeah, but maybe we need to say something. Why, from a technical perspective, is not a good idea? I don't know. Maybe.
I can't hear you.
It's fine to say there is a cost involved. There is a computing and a possibly a financial cost involved in doing reverse searching. That is why it is. That's why that is one of the reasons the RB Dragon's there.
I thought we had covered reverse search about 20 minutes ago with a specific action, so I'm kind of wondering what we missed that is causing us to cover it again.
So
the aggregation. Yeah, I think the aggregation is...
I know that Steve brought it back up, but I'm wondering what was insufficient in our prior plan that requires us to go over it again.
So I don't think what Steve brought up any insufficiencies in what we said previously, other than I made the comment that maybe we need to explain, maybe in an appendix somewhere, what tools like domain tools were doing and the implications upon that, because it's not just a cost issue. There are very significant policy issues on that. And if we wanted this system to try to do all that, then that's a whole new set of policy issues that need to be addressed.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. All right. So we've kind of... Oh, there was one thing that I saw in the in the comments that this was in the NCSG session yesterday. That it sounded like a valid thing that we should think about putting in the document. This was from Louise. She asked, wondering about metadata that's produced by the authorization service in terms of data storage, but also there might be metadata, you know, the authorization service, authentication server, et cetera. Should you not have some comments about what to do about that data, or that somebody should be making calls about what to do about that metadata? That struck me as an insightful thing that we had not thought about explicitly. So I think we ought to call that out in our document.
I truly don't understand this issue. Is there an example what this metadata is?
I think she mentioned it yesterday, right? She said somebody asks, there's a requester goes to the access gateways, you know, sends requests in and gets responses back, et cetera. If those systems are keeping that data, and then you're able to get a time sequenced log of all of that data, then you might be able to, without actually knowing who the requester is or other things, just looking at that mass of data back and forth, you might be able to figure out a pattern, and that metadata may give you clues about the requester, et cetera, that may blow up confidentiality or secrecy or other things like that. That's the way I interpreted her question, and that seemed like a valid one. I see Benedict and then Andy and Steve. I can't see you when you're raising your hand, Steve, so one of you guys will have to redirect, you know, bootstrap something.
That discussion veers in my mind into stuff that can get very sticky. It's inferential, and rather than trying to solve it or be definitive about it, I would maybe we should put that in as one of the questions that to be pursued over time, and sort of raise it as a question, and so that goes into the other considerations or whatever, so we can flag that and say we're not solving for that. But that's one of the things to study and understand about the structure of the system.
Okay. So if you go to Google Docs, the second link that was sent out to take notes, Diana has written all of this stuff down, and we are at 3 pages. Benedict.
I just wanted to give a name to what we were trying to describe in InfoSec. That's called data aggregation risk.
Data aggregation risk. Okay, got it. Thank you. Diana, that was on the last topic. Okay, so we have about 3 pages worth of notes that between all of us we've said are things that should be added to the document. Andy, myself, a couple of others, Jody, have made some notes in the questions document as well. Thinking back to what we did at the last meeting that worked quite well, it seems to me that we ought to actually go back to the original drafters of the various sections of the document, of the technical model document that we put out, and we should task each of those original authors to go back and look at the notes that we've made here and decide, you know, whether there are sections or segments that have to be added to your segment of the document. Okay, that's one suggestion that I have. The second is we need someone to volunteer to go write up or start up the FAQ section, which is a new section on the document. So it seems to me that those are two useful things that we should do. Andy?
Yeah, I mean, since the FAQ was my bright idea, I think I should be on the hook for it.
Okay, got it. Benedict?
I'll give you a hand, Andy.
Okay, great. Okay, so folks agree with that. Do all of you remember which sections you drafted? Okay. Elisa, Diana, you just, you know, make those notes back up, you know, take the document like you've done before, put comments in there so we know who is drafting it. We also had folks originally allocated on reviews, so please add that back so that we have drafters and reviewers,
We resolved all those comments in the document.
Sorry?
We resolved all those comments in the document.
Oh, so you lost that information.
I think I can pull it up. It just might take a little.
It's fine. We can just do it. We can just do it brand new now. So, systems requirements and user journey, etc., was you, Andy. Who were your reviewers? Do you remember?
That's a good question. I don't remember.
Okay, who wants to review that section? Jody and Tomofumi. Okay.
These came back from a search.
Wow.
Did it know?
Yeah, it knows who
reviewed. That's nuts. That's, you know. Weird. Okay. Assumptions, Steve, you'll take that? You won't take that.
I'll take the one I.
He's got a new section.
The logging and audit.
I know that's a new section, but I'm asking about whether you'll take a look at the assumptions piece and in the document, because you had some ideas on we should change the name of it, and you also had some suggestions on.
So there's two separate
other pieces in there.
So there's two separate things. One is just in some sense relabeling or recharacterizing what we currently have as assumptions, which is an important thing.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a lot of change to the content there except the casting.
Well, we had comments earlier on that are captured in the notes about some assumptions that we should state, you know, for...
Well, and then separately, things that I would consider to be assumptions,
correct,
which are things that we've assumed as we've gone through the
correct
design. So those are two separate things.
Two separate things. The segment formerly called assumptions and the segment to be called assumptions.
Yes.
Yeah?
And you want me to do both of those?
I'm asking if
you
would.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Who wants to review Steve's work? Sorry?
Tomofumi.
Tomofumi for the logging.
For the logging, Tomofumi, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Gavin, okay, for reviewing Steve's thing. Okay, then let's get to the proposed solution. Scott is the drafter. And who were your reviewers, Scott? I think Andy was one of you. Jorge was one of the reviewers. Who else wants to review Scott's piece?
Green thing. Yeah, to be clear, I think Gustavo and I are going to review everything.
Right.
Yeah. So we're on full review.
Yeah. Okay.
Scott's
the main person. Jorge is going to do the review.
Yeah.
Okay. Steve, your microphone. And then other considerations. Gavin is the author. Who are the who wants to review? Yeah, I was a reviewer. Jody will be a reviewer. Okay. FAQ was Andy. We got reviewers for that as well. Yes, Benedict. Okay, you're one of the reviewers. Okay, got it. Now, Andy, you also made some comments, I thought, about adding something to the executive summary or to the preamble, did you not?
Yes, I did. So it was about just the importance of privacy, and I can go back through and try to do that.
Okay, got it. Jody, you made some comments about liability, contracted party stuff, etc. So will you take those and figure out where those should go in and put them into the document?
Sure.
Okay. I am looking at the calendar, which is here somewhere. Diana, could you bring the calendar up on the screen? We have no calls scheduled for the next 2 weeks, primarily because next week is, you know, kind of the week after ICANN and the week prior to Prague, and then the week after that is Prague, right? So the ITF. So we've got nothing scheduled for the rest of this month. We've scheduled two calls in the first week of April, on the 2nd and the 4th, the Tuesday and the Thursday. Another call on the following Tuesday, and then a potential face-to-face. Just based on what we've done here, it seems to me that we do need a face-to-face.
Yeah?
Yeah? I'm sorry? You're suggesting that we have it in London.
Works for me. Doesn't matter to me.
I mean, It's a proposal, so I'm taking it seriously.
I mean, what are the costs?
So if you have questions, concerns, you should raise it now, or else it's likely to just become real. Okay. We're talking about April 15th, 16th. So I see Aliza's hand up and Diana's hand up, and before that, Tomofumi. You want to speak, Tomofumi? Okay. Aliza?
There we go. It's not easy to find space on very short notice, so that's why we had suggested either D.C. or Los Angeles again, so we could use an ICANN office. And we've already notified our meetings team that this was potentially going to happen, and we'd reserved this space and in D.C., I believe, right? So.
Diana?
No, I had the same concerns also about costs.
Okay. Gavin.
I can't comment on the costs, so I can, and I think they to take priority, but if the group says London, I might be able to help out with that. We're about to move into a brand new office, so it might be that we have space. If not, there are kind of other places we can make use of if need be. I have to say, I think it's a bit unfair to ask all you guys come all the way over to the UK, because most of you are in the US. But having said that, I'm not sure I can do another 2-day transatlantic trip, and I'll probably have to do it remotely. I can't speak for Benedict.
Okay, so, yeah, Jody?
I've just received a photo from my wife that says I have jury duty at that time.
You have jury duty.
And does it say you can do it from either Washington or London?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you have a business trip and you can show evidence, in many cases you'll be able to, get some consideration from a court. But who am I to say that's what you want to do? You may prefer jury duty to actually being with all of us.
This is my first time ever, so I
Well, Andy?
Yeah, I was just going to say the date, those dates work for me. The week after that does not. But I've noticed that the week after that is when we are saying we're releasing the final thing. So.
Okay. So, sorry. Who here is going to be in Prague? Okay. Right. I'm going to be there, but only for Monday. I'm flying home on Tuesday morning. So I was just wondering, you know, what the impact. Because if we're talking about like a 90-minute call from Prague, it's going to start at 6 p.m. It may, I mean, I won't speak for the people going to Prague, but it's worth maybe thinking about the feasibility of doing a call while we're in Prague. Well, some of us in Prague. Elisa?
Benedict just pointed out that the 15th or the 14th is Easter, so that could be a difficult travel day. I don't know if it is wrong.
I just looked it up. The 21st is Easter. Oh, I'm sorry. That's how I know I have vacation on the week after.
That's,
spring break.
14th is Benedict's Easter, and it's 21st for all the
rest
of us.
Never mind, excuse me.
Benedict's still on the Julian calendar.
I was thinking of my daughter's spring break.
Okay, so what I'll note here is that there's a request for London. There's a possibility, Elisa and Diana, that Gavin might be able to help with the actual facility to host the meeting. So what'll then be left is the travel costs as well as the hotel accommodation components, meals, etc. So you'll have to look into that. I mean, there are costs one way or the other, right? So we're not. But what I'd like to say, does anybody have an objection to that final meeting being in London?
I'd rather go to Europe, and that might not be Europe anymore by that time.
Well, okay.
So I was just going to point out that D.C. in April is actually quite lovely. The cherry blossoms might be out, so you might be missing out on something.
One thing I will say is if we do host it in the new Central Lake office, the three meeting rooms are named Surf, Postel, and Crocker.
Yeah, but it's Dave Crocker.
That's perfectly okay with me.
Okay, so then we'll leave that as an action specifically for Elisa and for Diana to come back. There's a request for London, but I would say that and we'll leave it with you to have a look. It seems to me that cost is the biggest factor that you have to consider. It seems that the members here are willing to travel to London if London is what we decide. So we leave the cost consideration back to you guys. If it's not London, it'll be DC. Okay, it's one or the other. It makes no sense because in the United States, the center of gravity for the TSG members is DC area, is the East Coast. So it makes no sense to cart everybody over to the West Coast. Sorry, Murray. Sorry, Tomofumi.
Yeah, London versus West Coast doesn't make any difference.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, I mean, if we end up running into issues with space in the D.C. area, like in the ICANN office or finding a hotel, I can almost certainly host it at the VeriSign HQ in Reston.
Okay.
So that too is a possibility.
We've already booked. We have space. We've already reserved our conference room. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to meet. Do we meet one day this time? Is that? Do we think that's all we need, or do we need 2 days? My gut is we need 2 days. And the second day might be a short day if we, you know, do well on the first day. But if past history is any guide, we make decent progress on the first day, but mulling over it that night or, you know, just sleeping on it and come back the next morning, it seems like we actually get even more stuff done. So that's my suggestion is 15th and 16th be the 2 days rather than just one day. Andy?
My only thing is that if you're going to make people travel and some people have to cross an ocean. Whichever one we're doing, we're crossing an ocean, that we should at least count on 2 days. And I would almost go further and say maybe 3 days just to be sure. It's because that's enormous expense and time and money. We better nail it.
Okay, so, John?
I'm just going to say, let's get this done. I'd hate to be at the end of a day and a half and find out, you know, we need to get together again or do things remotely that we could do better in a room.
Okay. So I'm hearing 15, 16, 17 then, with 17 penciled in and the ability to collapse 17 if you don't need it.
One thing I just mentioned with regards to the last item on our charter, the beer is better in London.
That too.
What? The beer is better in London.
Well, item number 13 on our charter is an important item, and my expectation is that on the 9th, we're going to have a significant amount of time on the agenda to make sure that we've got 13 actually locked down properly.
Yeah. So I with all due respect, I'm going to disagree with you on that. So,
I'm just going to say, you know, there are differing opinions, and one of you is right, and Andy is not.
And I'll say that regardless of all of that, we're going to need to put those opinions to the test. Okay. I think it's time to pass this around. Yeah, I think so. While that is happening, let me start doing a quick round here. I'd like to get your thoughts on what you thought has worked well this week. What you'd like to, you know, see done differently. I cannot hear you. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think we should have this recorded. You know, what you thought about, you know, what we've done so far, what we could do differently, and then we'll wrap for the day. Steve.
That's been an exemplary process as far as I'm concerned. I don't have any critique. Well done. Well done for you particularly, Ram. Well done for everybody. And particularly well done, the support staff. So this has been as good as it gets, I think.
Thank you, Steve. John?
I just wish there were more hours in the day at ICANN meetings. So I apologize for not being able to get to everything. But I think, as Steve said, exemplary. I wish everything... I guess smoothly is not the word, but everything went this well in our circles. Excellent.
Gustavo?
I don't have anything to say. It's really a good team.
Andy?
I think this has been a very good experience for me. I've attended ICANN meetings in the past kind of more as a traveler through it. And this is the first time I've actually experienced it. Good. No, it was enlightening. I thought the feedback, for the most part, was very good. So it's been a good session for me. I want to echo what Steve said. Someone earlier in the week, and I forgot who, said leadership matters, and that is so true. So Ram, thank you very much. Leadership does matter. And the other side, going back to the other thing that Steve said. I work for Aaron, and we have our own Aaron meetings, and so I'm somewhat familiar with what support staff have to put up with and what they have to do. And you guys are just awesome. So I cannot say enough about you.
Gavin.
Oh, everything he just said. Yeah, definitely. I'd also like to say to the guys who are like Andy, not regulars at the ICANN meetings, how well I thought you did when confronted with people like Elliot and Michaela, who are very intelligent and very insightful, but they can sometimes be challenging to respond to without getting too angry.
Benedict?
I loved it. There's one question. I wonder when we present stuff to the community whether we can be more explicit about where we think they can plug policy in. So without getting into policy, being really clear where we think the decisions are and what just to start to help frame the discussion.
It's been a pleasure to work with all of you. It's just great to work with a group that's this efficient and focused. So thank you for doing that and being smart and really fun too.
I don't have anything to add, but it has been a great experience.
Jody?
I don't have anything to add either. I mean, everything you guys have said is what has been going through my mind, so thank you all.
Tomofumi?
I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot. Cannot say anything else. Thank you very much.
Scott?
One of the things I continued to hear more than once this week was a sense of amazement that people have that we were given, you know, a task to do in a certain amount of time, a very short amount of time, and somehow we actually managed, well, we're not done yet, but so far we've managed to pull that off. That's not common here, folks, right? Nothing happens in the span of a few months. So I think that is a testament to the people who are here in this room, the way we organized ourselves and our willingness, to work together, towards getting a common goal accomplished. So thank you very much.
Let me just note, as long as we're singing your praises, that in the middle of all this, you managed to get yourself promoted in your day job.
Thank you, Diana.
No, I just wanted to repeat what Aliza said. It's been great working with everybody, and I actually did learn a lot. I'm not able to repeat it all, but I did learn a lot.
Okay, thank you, folks. I just want to share a couple of my own comments. First, it's just been a tremendous amount of fun intellectually just diving deep into technical matters and walking through the process. I had an idea. Go ahead.
So your new job, you don't expect to get to do that very often.
Exactly. From now on. At the very start, I remember being on a call with John and with Francisco, and we were going through the charter and the questions and stuff like that. And I was expressing great confidence that with the right team, we could, just make progress and get things done. And I think we've actually survived the political piece of all of this as well. And I had to say, after our presentations were done yesterday, I've had folks from the GAC, from the NCSG, from the BC, from the registries, okay, and from the registrars come to me and say, we're hearing nothing but good stuff about what you guys have done. This is good, etc. In the SAC, there is a meme floating out about Ram and his cool gang, because that's what Yoran labeled it the other day. Folks talking about cooling the gang and all of that. So it's actually the political piece of it, which often can get well-meaning efforts tripped up inside of ICANN, we've managed to, so far anyway, we're not done, but so far we've managed to get past that. That's one thing. The other thing is, in the EPDP discussion that we had on Sunday, I forget who it was, I think it was Benedict who was saying that it started off with what felt like some tension. But as the questions and answers went further, it kind of the level went down. So I think it actually helped, even though we, things like assumptions, etc., we could have been more explicit. I think it actually helped that we were fairly clear about what we know, what we don't know, what was given to us, etc. So I think that is a fairly good model. And finally, thank you for your good words about me. I've had fun doing it, I think it'll be great to finish this up and put this out. A couple of folks have come to me and have suggested that outside of the TSG work and outside of the output, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, that two other things ought to come out from this. One is a collective piece from us that talks about what it was about this thing that made it work. Because there's been a bunch of folks who've come up and, you know, said what Scott was saying. This is not the norm here in an ICANN environment, right? And, you know, that's layer 9 stuff, but if we feel motivated to go do that, maybe on day 3 or something, if we are done, you know, we could think about that. That's one thing. The other thing that some folks came and said was to actually go and tabulate how many hours, how much time we actually put into this, and to arrive at some guesstimate of the cost, of the value, you know, of the collected hours, etc., so that the output that we put out, the work that comes out, has a cost associated with it, because everybody says it's volunteer hours, it's volunteer time, etc., but it actually costs real money. Our employers made choices, etc. So it may be that we don't put an exact number. We don't say this was $347,420 or something like that, but we might be able to say, you know, in a range of $300,000 to $600,000 or something like that. So folks understand the scale and scope of the effort. So those are two suggestions that came my way, and I'd like to hear you folks, you know, what you think about it. John?
It sounds like that second layer 9 one is a perfect thing for during agenda item 13.
I think putting some sort of cost estimate on it's a great idea. As far as what made this work, I think we may want to have to come to terms with this may have been a unicorn, because it's not only the focused effort and the tight time schedule and whatnot, but a lot of it is also the people. And you can put together another set of 10 or 14 people, and they may all hate each other's guts. So,
yeah, I was quite closely involved in all of the work to design the Trademark Clearinghouse, and there was a meeting in Brussels, a two-day meeting in Brussels, where we had a similar but much larger gathering of people discussing how it should all work. My recollection was, I mean, that succeeded in its task of making the Trademark Clearinghouse workable as an entity, but it took an awful lot longer. And I don't know if it was because it was deliberately quite a small group that made it that way. I don't know. But, I think if we can find some useful lessons for how we do stuff like this in future inside this community, I think that would really benefit everyone.
Jody?
Well, now I know who to talk to about the TMCH.
You should have seen what it would have been like first.
Okay. But, I think it's fairly obvious why this works so well. I mean, legal and policy weren't here, so.
Okay. Thanks. I think we're done. Drinks with your on 5, yes.